This week on The Score, who will win this year's Oscars? How did Venezuela reach the tipping point? Can a 1952 Supreme Court decision upend Donald Trump's border wall emergency? All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Venezuela was once one of Latin America's richest countries. Its people are now jobless, hungry, and rushing for the borders. How did this happen? Our first guest is a Venezuelan economics student, Daniel DiMartino, who is working toward a degree at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. A recent piece he wrote in USA Today about his home country brought him to the attention of The Score. We spoke by telephone earlier this week. In American politics today, people are throwing around the word socialism as though it's something benign and not malignant, but you've lived through a socialist state, and you escaped from it. What can you tell me about what life was like in Venezuela under the socialist regime?
Yeah, Rick, thank you for having me. Socialism in Venezuela really made my life, and the life of my friends and the life of my family, one that nobody in the U.S., I think, can really imagine. I had to do lines for hours, make lines for hours to buy basic groceries, to buy toilet paper, to buy anything I needed. And if I did not do that, because sometimes, you know, the quote that the government gave you, because the government rationed how much food you could get and what you could get, how many toothpastes, tubes you could get, everything, I just had to go to the black market and pay excessively high prices. And therefore, everything we earned, my family, by the time we left, we just spent it on food. That was the only thing we could buy.
We're talking with Daniel DiMartino, who's a contributor to Young Voices and who recently had an opinion piece in USA Today about this topic. We're talking about socialism in Venezuela and how that country has devolved over the years. Before you were born, Venezuela was one of the richest and most stable democracies in South America. What happened to create this crisis that we're seeing today?
Right. Well, many things happened. Venezuela in the 1950s through the 1970s was, as you say, a very, very rich country, one of the richest countries in the hemisphere and in the world. My grandparents immigrated to Venezuela in the 1950s, and just like many other immigrants in the United States and others in Venezuela, it was the American dream in Venezuela. But since the governments, democratically elected governments in Venezuela, nationalized oil, the government had too much power, and they wasted their power by basically throwing away all those resources, spending it on welfare and infrastructure projects that were useless. And the government, democratic governments of Venezuela, got into too much debt. So the economy just stagnated from the 70s to the 90s. And as you know, historically, bad economies produce terrible election results. And that's what happened in 1998 when the Venezuelan people were tired and they elected Chavez. What the Venezuelan people didn't know was that Chavez was going to make Venezuela go even more downhill, which is what happened.
And we see the results today under Maduro and, you know, millions of Venezuelans like yourself leaving the country. And that, of course, makes the situation even worse because the human element of making an economy great becomes diminished.
You are 100%. There is a massive human capital diminishment in Venezuela just because everybody who has a college degree in it and everybody who has graduated high school is leaving the country in the masses. I have friends throughout the world. I think I have a friend in every continent and in half, like in 50 countries. It's just unbelievable. So I think that it is definitely a terrible situation. There are hundreds of thousands of children who are actually in the risk of dying within the next few months due to preventable diseases, such as measles, such as TB, because there are no medicines to cure them, and also because they are all malnourished.
One thing that it seems differs between Venezuela and, say, Cuba under the Castros or the Soviet Union is that it does not seem to have wanted to or acted on exporting its bad political and economic system, or am I misreading that situation?
I would say that that's not the case, Rick. I would say that Venezuela, in fact, has sponsored socialist and communist political parties around the world. There is a political party in Spain who right now, it's actually part of the coalition government, who was funded in the millions of euros by the Venezuelan regime that is called Podemos, and it is a very powerful force which Venezuelans oppose strongly in Spain. There are also allegations of political parties such as the governing party in Greece, who were funded by Hugo Chavez previously with oil money, and Maduro and Chavez all gave oil money to small Caribbean islands to buy their boats in the United Nations. So this socialism, in real radical socialism, in Latin America, Cuba, Venezuela, has always wanted to export its ideology to ruin other countries.
I think that's a very underreported aspect of this situation, and it's one that deserves more exploration. But before we do that, I'd like to get your opinion as a student of economics as to how Venezuela can recover from this situation.
Thank you for asking that, Rick. Yes. So Venezuela, like any other country, needs some very basic things to prosper. Among them is the protection of private property. That is the main thing that socialism destroys. And for your listeners to understand this, there is a big difference between what U.S. politicians call socialism in Europe and what is real socialism in Venezuela. Real socialism means the elimination or the practical elimination of private property rights, meaning that you don't own businesses. In Venezuela, Chavez and Maduro nationalized basically every large industry with only small shops being left. So if we guarantee private property in Venezuela again, and we privatize all these companies and return them to their rightful owners that Chavez and Maduro took away from them, that's the first step to return production and to solve the humanitarian crisis. Then we need to eliminate the price controls that have destroyed the few private businesses that are left, because just in basic economics, as everybody will learn it, if you impose a price cap, there will always be shortages, which is why I had to do lines for hours, and which is why there is this massive humanitarian crisis. Inflation, like the government wants to control through price controls, is really not going to ever be tamed through government action, but by stopping the printing press of money, which is the other great cause of the crisis in Venezuela.
When you listen to American politicians like Bernie Sanders or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they talk about Scandinavian countries as being models of socialism, when in fact, if you look at the Index of Economic Freedom, those countries are freer economically than the United States is, and certainly are nothing like Venezuela as you describe it.
You are 100% right, Rick. Yes, it is true that those countries have, on average, higher taxes and greater welfare states than the United States. That is all true. However, while they do have more government intervention in those areas, in every other area, they are above and even better and freer than the United States. They guarantee property rights better. They have better courts and justice systems. They allow for even more political freedom. It is basically what makes a country able to invest, able to be a country that can grow and that attracts private investment. So if Bernie Sanders, if all these leftist politicians in the United States would like to become more like Norway, then instead of just focusing on their welfare state, why don't we focus on eliminating licensing requirements in the United States? Why don't we focus on eliminating the minimum wage, which many of these countries don't even have? Or why don't we focus even on lowering the corporate tax rate? Because these countries do impose taxes on the rich, but they impose even lower taxes on corporations than America.
That's very insightful. In the last 30 seconds or so that we have left, I wonder what your advice is to American politicians and leaders in the State Department and other government agencies as to how we should react to what's going on in Venezuela and where we should be taking our policy in the near future.
Yes. So I really want to commend President Trump for this because it's really been great, the actions that he has taken. We can criticize him for many things, but in the matter of Venezuela, he has done exactly what he needs to do, and we would have never achieved the how close we are to freedom in Venezuela were not for the United States and all these other countries supporting, led by the U.S. So what I encourage the administration to continue doing is keep ramping up the pressure against Maduro, because this is a murderous regime. This is a narco-terrorist regime, Rick. And they will not live voluntarily. If we don't have the help of the international community doing everything they can to push them out of power, this is never going to end. And we need to end it soon to save hundreds of thousands of lives.
Well, that is both pessimistic and optimistic in its ways. But Daniel DiMartino, I appreciate your joining us on the Score from Bering Drift. And I wish you luck in your studies. And I hope that someday you can return to your home country when it's free.
Me too, very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, Rick.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
This week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the U.S. Constitution's prohibition of excessive fines applies to the states as well as the federal government. I spoke to the Cato Institute's Ilya Shapiro about this, and also the legal remedies Congress and the courts might have if they want to overturn President Trump's border wall state of emergency. Shapiro and I talked on Thursday by telephone. This week, the Supreme Court had a major unanimous decision on excessive fines. The case was Timms v. Indiana. Can you explain what was going on there and why we should be paying attention?
Sure. This is a case where Mr. Timms was prosecuted and convicted of a small-time drug offense and was sentenced to probation and very minor penalties, but also the car in which he was arrested was confiscated and forfeited. Now, the maximum statutory fine for the crime of which he was convicted is $10,000. The value of the car that was seized, the Land Rover, is about $40,000. So his counsel raised a claim that this was an excessive fine violating the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment and excessive fines. Now, he won at the first couple of levels of the Indiana courts on that, but the Indiana Supreme Court reversed because it turns out the excessive fines clause has never been in what's called incorporated against the states. That is, the way that jurisprudence has progressed, different parts of the Bill of Rights have been applied to the states by the Supreme Court at different times. Almost all of the Bill of Rights has been extended to the states, but this one provision is one of the very few that has not. And so the question before the Supreme Court was whether the excessive fines clause does indeed apply to the states, and the court was unanimous on that question. Now it's going to get sent back down to determine whether the $40,000 confiscation of his car is an excessive fine. Almost certainly he'll win on that, but the main point is this is another avenue that now individuals can get into federal court to challenge state violations of their rights. And there's an interesting interplay between what part of the 14th Amendment, which is the constitutional amendment after the Civil War that applied constitutional protections against state violations, what part of that is used to apply protections against the states. The Due Process Clause, people talk about substantive due process and whether that's gotten out of hand, or the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and Justices Thomas and Gorsuch would have gone with the latter.
We're talking with Ilya Shapiro, who's a legal scholar at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., and I'd like to look into that a little bit more. The Privileges or Immunities Clause is something that Justice Thomas has been talking about for a long time, but most of the other justices have not been joining him in that discussion. But Justice Gorsuch seems to be interested in exploring this on other cases. Could you expand on that a bit?
Sure. When the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, so the Reconstruction Congress after the Civil War, the key idea, in addition to abolishing slavery with the 13th Amendment, was to make sure that states couldn't oppress their citizens, and if they did, if they violated their rights in various ways, you could get into federal court to challenge that action. And the 14th Amendment contains three key provisions. The Due Process Clause, you can't be deprived of your life, liberty, or property without due process of law. The Equal Protection Clause, all people are entitled to the equal protection of the laws, and the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And that was, the Privileges or Immunities Clause was really supposed to, if you read the debates at the time, supposed to do most of the substantive work in terms of if the states were censoring you and violating your speech rights, or if the police were searching your house without a warrant, taking your property without just compensation. All of these protections in the Bill of Rights and more, these were supposed to come under the Privileges or Immunities of Citizenship. 5 years after the 14th Amendment was enacted, however, the Supreme Court decided a case called the Slaughterhouse Cases, involving a monopoly on slaughterhouses that the city of New Orleans was granting, and other competing slaughterhouses, butchers, were upset that this was violating their economic liberties, and the Supreme Court said, no, that clause, that only protects things that come directly from federal citizenship, like very obscure things, nothing that we even think about. And so, in effect, that put an end to constitutional protections from state violations of your rights until the 20s and 30s, when, under a different theory, under the Due Process Clause, different aspects of rights protections, mostly under the Bill of Rights, were, as I said, quote, incorporated against the states. And the issue here is, well, people say, well, why does it matter which clause you use? At this point, essentially all of the Bill of Rights has been incorporated. We still have these battles about unenumerated rights, that is, the Constitution protects individual rights, not just those that are listed in the Bill of Rights. There are others, and we have debates about that. You know, abortion comes into that. Lots of other controversial, some non-controversial things go into that. Well, why would we just change, you know, to this? This is an academic exercise, changing to these clauses. And the answer to that is that the Privileges or Immunities Clause actually has that textual basis, again, from these debates in the 1860s about what protections come under the 14th Amendment. And whereas the Due Process Clause was supposed to be narrower and has come to be interpreted to be, well, whatever you can get five votes for at the Supreme Court, it's constitutionally unmoored. So the worst that could happen from switching clauses is the exact same that we have now. But there's high upside because you can have a more constitutionally faithful way of protecting rights. And as you said, Justice Thomas was really the only one that had an interest in this, the case of McDonald versus City of Chicago in 2010 that applied the right to bear arms against the states after District of Columbia versus Heller in 2008 declared that the Second Amendment protected that individual right. McDonald versus Chicago extended it to the states. And there, that was a 5-4 decision, conservatives over liberals, with Thomas providing the key fifth vote and saying, I don't agree with the Due Process Clause analysis, has to go through privileges or immunities. And now with the Timms decision, Gorsuch joins him in saying that, as an original matter, privileges or immunities is much more faithful. Maybe in the future appropriate case, we'll need to do more with that.
Oh, that was a great explanation, and we'll be linking to your article about that on the Cato Institute website that you've published this morning. I'd like to get to another issue, which is the national emergency that the president declared at the border last week. You've written about this as well. I think a lot of us are very concerned about the precedent this sets, not so much for future emergencies, but future non-emergencies. And what is the role that Congress can play in overturning a declaration like this, or at least mitigating it?
Well, there are three real issues at play here. One is the declaration of emergency. The second is the statutes that it triggers to access pots of money and otherwise under hundreds of statutes that are activated whenever there's an emergency declaration. And the third point is kind of a broader constitutional one about Congress giving this kind of power to the executive. So first, the National Emergencies Act was passed in 1976 not to give the president broader power to declare emergencies, but quite to the contrary, in the wake of Watergate, to limit the power that presidents have been exercising for a long, long time. I mean, President Lincoln would do things on an emergency basis because during a war, he couldn't get Congress physically back in time, that sort of thing. Woodrow Wilson was the first president to officially declare a proclamation of emergency, and presidents since then have been doing it. The National Emergencies Act said that when the president declares an emergency, without defining what an emergency is, then certain other statutes are triggered, and Congress, by a majority vote, can end the emergency if it disagrees with the president. The problem with that is about 5 years later, the Supreme Court, in a case called INS versus Chadha, not related to emergencies, but struck down what's called a legislative veto. That is, Congress, under our constitutional structure, can't veto what the president is doing if he's lawfully exercising his powers. And so that provision of the National Emergencies Act is dead letter, and you go back to the idea that you need a supermajority. You need a veto-proof two-thirds in each house to be able to overturn that kind of presidential declaration. Now, the question of is something really an emergency? No court has ever looked at that, again, because no statute defines it. I mean, in terms of common sense, native English speaker reading, it would have to be something that's happened suddenly and there's an urgent need to act, that's something like that. But common sense English language reading isn't necessarily what courts do. And so I think if this came to a court, or to the Supreme Court at least, they really wouldn't want to take a position on second-guessing whether something's an emergency or not. And indeed, we have plenty of emergencies that have been declared, I think 58 since the Act went into being in 1976, 32 of which are still ongoing. I bet you don't know that we're still under a state of emergency because there was fraud in the Belarusian presidential election of 2006. Indeed, we're still in a state of emergency because Iran took hostages in 1979. There are plenty of these things. You don't necessarily hear about them because a lot of them involve foreign policy or international trade. A lot of them involve trade sanctions and such. But this one is high profile because it involves the border and immigration and our polarized time and all that. So, you know, we can argue about whether there really is an emergency here or not, but courts might be wary of second-guessing the executive on things like that. So really, if I were advising Congress, I would advise them to amend the Emergencies Act to just say that it sunsets within a certain amount of time, 30 days, 10 days, 60 days, whatever Congress decides. Unless Congress affirms it, then it just ends on its own terms. But anyway, that's not the current law. So anyway, what does that declaration do? Well, it allows the executive to access funds that have been appropriated by Congress, because the president can't spend money that has not been appropriated by Congress. That's a clear text of the Constitution, the Appropriations Clause in Article 1. And so money that has not been spent can be shifted around to a purpose that's statutorily similar to what it was otherwise to be used for. So in this case, there was money appropriated for military construction, military bases, fences, all sorts of things that the military is doing, and it's now going to be used for wall construction. Now, the key term there isn't whether the wall is close enough to military construction or fences or roads and things like this, but that provision says that it's to be used for things that where armed forces are required our armed forces required to, for wall construction? I don't know, but that's something that I think will be fought out in the courts. What's interesting is that before we even get to that provision, and a related one about using funds for drug interdiction, there is plenty of money that has already been appropriated by Congress, first of all, for wall construction in this latest budget, but also during the lame duck under President Obama, in terms of funding the Department of Homeland Security for certain upgrades along the border. And so the argument is that money has already been appropriated for these purposes, and we're going to access those funds before we even get to the funds that are triggered by the emergency. So that might affect the timing of when someone even has standing to sue over the emergency, whether it's a landowner whose land is being condemned, use of eminent domain for the border construction, or anyone else. And then finally, even if we've gone through all of that nitty-gritty lawyerly parsing of all of those different statutes and figured out that, yes, actually the statutory language is broad enough to cover the discretionary movement of these funds from what they were otherwise planned to be used for to the construction of the wall, well, at that point, that means Congress is just delegating too broad a power. That is, we have this principle called the non-delegation doctrine, whereby each branch of government, the legislative, executive, and judicial, cannot delegate its power to another branch. So in the most extreme example, let's say Congress says, we love the president, he's a great guy, he knows exactly what needs to be done, we're just going to say he can rule by decree. In general, or in a particular area of policy, that would very quickly be struck down, because you simply can't say, we're going to make the president a king. You know, where Congress doesn't have that power. The problem is, we haven't had such extreme delegations, and the Supreme Court has not struck down a congressional piece of legislation under this non-delegation doctrine since 1935. And so this raises broader constitutional separation of powers concerns with very little precedent. What will courts do about this? And regardless of what the courts would do, I think Mike Lee had a good reaction. I saw him on Twitter. I think he put it out as a press release that even if it's more likely than not that what President Trump is doing here comes within the four corners of the law, that's very troublesome, and Congress really needs to reassert its authority and take back this broad delegation.
There are a lot of moving parts there. It sounds quite complicated. We only have about 30 seconds left, so you mentioned that the courts may feel self-restrained about second-guessing the president, but I wonder what role might be played by the Youngstown Steel decision from 1952. I interviewed another legal scholar about this the other day, and I'd just like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, Youngstown Steel was in the context of Harry Truman seizing steel factories during the Korean War, and it was argued under the inherent power of the president. It's a little different because here we have a statutory scheme, but at the end of the day, the last thing that I was talking about, the separation of powers and delegation, if indeed the president is acting against the express will of Congress because Congress considered the issue and only gave him a certain amount of money, then that certainly does look worse in terms of executive power if the courts wanted to rein him in.
Ilya Shapiro, thank you for your comments today. I appreciate you filling us in on all these details. I hope sometime soon we get a chance to talk about these things in person, but I appreciate your joining us on The Score from Bering Drift.
My pleasure. Take care.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
When The Score returns, we'll chat with film critic Tim Halsey about this year's Oscars and with law professor John Barrett about a 1952 Supreme Court case that may stand in the way of Donald Trump's emergency on the Mexican border. The Score will be right back. Don't wander too far.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score. I'm Rick Sincere. This Sunday night, Hollywood presents the movie industry's top awards. I sat down with the score's film critic, Tim Halsey, about who might win the Oscars and what we'll be talking about Monday morning. I met with Tim outside a coffee shop, so you may hear some streetscape sounds in the background. The 90th Annual Academy Awards are coming up on Sunday. Just give me your thoughts. What's going to be the standout?
Right now, the big standout is how little this has dominated entertainment news over the past month. Usually when we have the Academy Awards, we have the Oscar campaigns. Everyone's paying close attention to who's up, who's down, who might win, who might lose. And that hasn't been the case this year. We've been completely dominated by the Jussie Smollett hate crimes charges. So by this point, in a lot of ways, we're just not paying very close attention to the Oscars this year, and that's very strange. We don't have a host this year. The first choice for a host, Dwayne Johnson, bowed out. Kevin Hart was chosen, and then we found out that he had some rather nasty tweets in his past, so he was out. And now we don't have a host at all. And the last time that happened was 1989. And if you remember the 1989 Oscars, that was a famous disaster. The opening number, Rob Lowe danced a boogie with Snow White.
I do remember. We're talking with Tim Halsey, the score's film critic and cultural critic, and we're discussing the 2019 Academy Awards. The Oscars are coming up. There does seem to have been some jockeying for some of the acting awards, and there seems to be a string of other awards who are going to Glenn Close for The Wife and to Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody. Do you think those are shoe-ins for Best Actress and Best Actor?
It sure seems that way. Glenn Close has been nominated. This will be Glenn Close's seventh nomination. She is the Susan Lucci of the Academy Awards. Eventually, she's got to win for something, and it looks like the Academy's ready to finally give it to her. Not very many people have seen The Wife. Hasn't had much of a release, but it's Glenn Close's turn. And the other actresses in this category just seem pretty much happy to be there.
Yeah, especially Lady Gaga, who is her first film and, you know, her first nomination.
There's a good chance that she'll get Best Original Song for Shallow.
Well, that would be a good consolation prize. Another surprising aspect of this year's Academy Awards is two distinguished veteran filmmakers, Spike Lee and Paul Schrader, are both nominated for the first time in their careers. What do you make of that?
Well, Lee's received a Special Achievement Award before, and he got his start with a Student Academy Award for his first film, Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads. That's actually what launched his career. So Spike Lee is long overdue, although I don't think Black Klansman is his best film. I don't think it's his best film since his last film. But it has the distinction of being perhaps the wokest entry, and that may go a long way with the Academy voters. If you look at the Best Picture presenters, for example, among them are Congressman John Lewis, Trevor Noah, Barbara Streisand, Chef Jose Andres. I mean, this is practically a who's who of celebrities against Trump.
And this may be a reason why Roma might have an upper hand for certainly Best Foreign Film, but perhaps also Best Picture.
Yes, Roma and Black Klansman are competing for the title of Wokest Picture. I don't know what Roma's chances are because, first of all, there's the Netflix factor, and we haven't really seen how that's gonna play in yet.
Yeah, I was just mentioning that Roma seems to have been made by Alfonso Cuarón for viewing on the small screen rather than the big screen.
Oh, he shot it on 65mm film.
Oh, he did?
He shot it on 65mm film. This is an epic motion picture. He just put it on Netflix because he figured with a small project, personal project, with no stars to speak of, in Spanish and mixed tech, if you have a project like this, the commercial potential is practically nil. Well, in fact, where Roma has played it's actually been very popular. It's had a good per theater average, but it just hasn't played many theaters.
It was at the Virginia Film Festival last November.
It was, and it's currently playing in a couple of theaters around the state. It's also played New York and L.A.
Which it needed to do to qualify for the Academy Awards. I think you have to be in a theater in New York or Los Angeles for a total of 2 weeks in order to qualify for a nomination.
That's right. And this one played for a few weeks before going to Netflix in December.
Yeah. What about the best animated feature category? For a change this year, I've actually seen most of the nominated films in that category.
That's not surprising, because the animated features were the ones that actually played to mainstream audiences. If you look at the Best Picture nominees, there are three blockbusters in the bunch. One's Black Panther, which you've probably seen.
I saw that the night it opened.
And Bohemian Rhapsody, which Rami Malek is probably going to win Best Actor for. There are a couple of others that qualify as well. Star is Born has grossed nearly $500 million worldwide, and that did very well.
And but, that's got a possible supporting actor nominee winning in Sam Elliott, who's also overdue for an Academy Award.
He is, but part of me thinks that Mahershala Ali is going to get this one again.
Second time for playing a black gay man.
Yes, for Green Book, which this is Green Book's real chance to snag an award, and the Academy usually loves stories like this. Green Book has been unusually controversial, I think, because the Academy Awards are remembering Driving Miss Daisy from 30 years ago.
Yeah, they look at it as a white savior picture. But Bret Easton Ellis made an interesting point in his article in the Hollywood Reporter the other day, and said that this is the story of Viggo Mortensen's character. It's not the story of Mahershala Ali's character, and that's why people are misperceiving it.
Well, Mahershala Ali's character is in the supporting actor column.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Of the other actors in the supporting actor category, really Sam Elliott is pretty much the only one, I think, who stands a chance against Ali. But I don't really know if Sam Elliott will win this.
You never know. I mean, the supporting actor categories tend to be the ones that come up with the greatest surprises. Think of My Cousin Vinny. Who was the woman who won that?
Marissa Tomei.
It's like the whole audience went up with a gasp when she was announced.
In part because comedies never win.
Right.
And you'll find, of course, no comedies in the list of...
There haven't been a lot of big comedies this year at all.
Well, there have been big comedies, but they haven't been the kind that either set the box office on fire, or that set the awards season on fire. The first film to sweep all the major acting awards was a comedy. It happened one night in 1934.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, I don't remember that, but I know that, and I've seen the movie, and it deserved the awards.
This is one of the things that we're seeing. I mean, cinema culture is really much more of a home phenomenon now than something you see in a theater. So if you saw It Happen One Night, you probably saw it on TV. You probably saw it on Turner Classic Movies or on DVD or something like that. And that's where you're going to see most of the Academy Award-nominated films this year as well.
It seems that the only movies that people go into the theaters to see these days are the big blockbuster comic book hero movies, like Black Panther, which has grossed, what, $1 billion?
$1.3 billion. Yes, this has been a monster hit. It literally has the Star Wars slot. You remember Star Wars in 77 had an Academy Award nomination for Best Picture. No one thought it would win, and it didn't, of course. But at the same time,
it lost to Annie Hall. So 77 was a big year for great movies.
Yes. Well, the entire American New Wave sort of came to fruition at that time. Yes, this is a big deal. You'll notice we're not talking about The Favorite.
which is a kind of quirky movie. I haven't seen it, but it has its boosters. What about Olivia Colman is a best actress winner? She won the Golden Globe.
She's up against Glenn Close.
Oh, and they were in different categories.
Yes.
At the Golden Globe.
Glenn, I think this is Glenn Close's year.
Yeah. I mean, and she's 71 years old. Her first nomination was in 1982, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah, and she's been around for a long time. And the fact that she didn't win for Fatal Attraction is just, it's incomprehensible.
I think that Olivia Colman is unlikely to win. The favorite, if it wins anything, it will probably win Best Original Screenplay. It's a very tricky little film. The cinematography is very good, but I don't think it will win for cinematography. I think Caleb Deschanel will win for Never Look Away, the German nominee for foreign language film. He's another one who's been nominated several times and whose work in the community is so highly respected, but he's never actually won.
We're running out of time, so I just want to ask you, what do you think will be the biggest surprise on Oscar night, the one that people will come away with the next day talking over their coffee at the office?
I think what people are going to talk about over their coffee at the office is not going to be an award at all. I think it's going to happen when Bette Midler sings a song from Mary Poppins Returns, The Place Where Lost Things Go, which is a three-hanky tearjerker of a song, and Bette Midler is going to milk it for everything she can get out of it. I think that's what people are going to be talking about at the Oscars. I don't even think they're going to be talking about who won or who lost.
And will that song win?
No. No, I think Shallow will win from A Star Is Born. But that one will definitely be a highlight of the evening.
Well, I think all of the listeners to The Score are going to be grabbing their popcorn and watching the award ceremony on Sunday night and find out on Monday whether any of these predictions come true.
Here we go.
Thanks, Tim.
You bet.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
John Q. Barrett is a professor of law at St. John's University in New York. He is an expert on the legal legacy of former Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, whose opinion in the so-called Youngstown Steel case of 1952 bears strongly on the lawfulness of President Trump's recently proclaimed state of emergency on the southern border. Professor Barrett spoke to me by telephone on Tuesday evening. Last week, President Trump declared a state of emergency on the southern border, which has caused a lot of controversy because there doesn't actually seem to be an emergency. There's a precedent that we may be looking at way back during the Korean War involving Youngstown Steel. What was that all about?
During the winter of 1951-52, the steel workers were about to go on strike, and the company would not meet their wage demands, and the steel mills were about to shut down during the Korean War and the nuclear arms buildup, which all needed steel. So Harry Truman exercised executive power and seized the steel mills, producing a monumental Supreme Court battle and a decision which he lost, which is now a landmark in our constitutional law.
We're talking with Professor John Barrett, who teaches law at St. John's University in New York. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should note that John and I go way back. We were on the debate team together in high school, and we also went to college together. And you're an expert on the life and career of Justice Robert Jackson, who, among other things, was the chief U.S. prosecutor at the War Crimes Tribunal in Nuremberg, which is another story altogether. But he wrote a very influential concurring decision in that Steele case. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Right. Well, Jackson had been Attorney General under Roosevelt, so he knew executive power up close, and he had advised Roosevelt during the first year, really, of the Nazis having conquered Europe on plant seizure issues to increase American defense production. That was used by the Truman administration as historical precedent. They were arguing to Justice Jackson, in effect, we can seize the steel mills because presidents can do that, as you told Franklin Roosevelt in 1940 and 1941. Jackson, in his judicial opinion, which was a concurring opinion, he was one of the six justices in the majority, sort of stepped back and said, things might look different when one is a judge than when one is an advocate. And as I read the Constitution, it does not create emergency power or recognize emergency power for the president. The way to seize private property is by legislation and then by paying just compensation for takings of property for public use. None of that happened here, and so the president is sort of out on his own, and he's out beyond his own constitutional power.
And bringing this up to the present day, it looks like there are several different groups and individuals planning on suing the Trump administration, 16 states, and I assume some individuals, and even talk about the U.S. House of Representatives suing the administration. Who would have standing to assert an injury in this declaration of emergency that could sue the president and get the emergency overturned?
Well, I think that will be fiercely litigated. The states have theories that they have already been injured, including because any reprogramming of money will take wall money from construction projects that would have gone forward in states and benefited their economies, employed their citizens, protected their interests as states. Plus, there is argument that the environmental damage that might be caused by wall construction would impact the states, and you know, various other theories. In addition to the state governments, the Congress will articulate, if it sues, its power of the purse, that the Constitution in Article 1 gives Congress the exclusive constitutional control to appropriate funds, and the president has skipped over them here and, in effect, injured them constitutionally. Also, if private property owners, in fact, are targeted and their land is seized and wall is built on their property, will have different kinds of tangible claims. So we'll see how it develops, but there are a lot of theories being floated around.
It's said that there's also a non-judicial remedy here, that under the National Emergencies Act of 1976, Congress can pass a resolution overturning the emergency, although it would require the signature of the president. But looking at that law, it reminds me of the War Powers Resolution, which Congress is trying to constrain the power of the executive, but in effect wrote laws that broadened the executive authority.
Right.
Do you read it the same way?
That is the genesis of this statute, but it developed in a kind of two-step almost accident. It was an effort to rein in presidential emergency declarations by giving Congress a disapproval power. And then when the Supreme Court struck down the legislative veto in the Chadha case, the statute was amended to have a resolution of disapproval be passed as ordinary legislation. But that means it has to go to the president, and if he vetoes it, it needs two-thirds of each House to override the veto. So, in effect, the reduction of presidential power after the Chadha decision has been at least a reinforcement and maybe an expansion of presidential power accidentally.
Yeah, and ironically. And it also seems that the National Emergencies Act doesn't really define what an emergency is and what the president can declare to be an emergency. Is that true?
No, that is true. Remember, at the time it was written, Congress thought it had the last word because it had a legislative veto built into the original version. So I think it could leave that undefined and in a particular event would have the power to say we disagree and to stop the presidentially declared emergency. That's changed by the new statute. It requires a presidential signature to override, to take away the statutory power.
Do you think that this current situation might provide an impetus for Congress to pass a better defined National Emergencies Act that actually says an emergency has to have X, Y, and Z before it can be declared?
Yeah, I think in theory this would be a wonderful occasion to do that. In practice, the majority in the Senate that supports the president gives him a legislative base that will not enact such a statute, at least not right now. And if somehow that changed, it's hard to imagine 67 senators overriding what would certainly be a veto by the president of such a statute. So I don't see between now and the end of 2020 this Congress and this president together producing a new statute that would rein in the current statute.
We began the conversation by talking about the Youngstown Steel case. Are there any other judicial precedents that apply in this arena?
Well, there is a sort of run of Youngstown progeny. The case that Dames and Moore versus Regan decided by the court in the 1980s, which grew out of the Iranian hostage release and settlement, is another case about executive power and the use of the emergency power under a different statute by President Reagan, basically to extinguish American company claims against the Iranian government and seizures of Iranian assets in the United States. In effect, that money was released to obtain the freedom of the Americans who had been held hostage in Tehran. And that opinion by then-Justice Rehnquist is a quite executive-friendly gloss on the inherent powers of the presidency in the realm of national security under an emergency statute. Again, not this particular one, but a sort of near cousin. And I think that also has some interpretive relationship to today's issue.
I want to switch gears just for a moment while I have you on the phone, because we're talking about your expertise on Robert Jackson. But recently in the news, there was a case in Florida where an elementary school student was arrested for refusing to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. And I'd just like to go back to West Virginia versus Barnett and Justice Jackson's opinion there, which was so influential and so widely ignored, it seems. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. I don't know the ins and outs of the Florida case, but generally Barnett, overwhelmingly reaffirmed by many subsequent courts, was a decision in the throes of World War II that recognized the First Amendment rights of Jehovah's Witness school children to refuse on religious scruples to stand and salute the American flag and pledge allegiance. Jackson wrote for the court that if there's any fixed star in the constitutional constellation, it's that officials can't prescribe what's orthodox and compel people to state their belief therein. And so, I think what happens is that these First Amendment principles are well known kind of in the upper echelons, but sometimes the school district doesn't include a memorandum or regular training in the packet every year for teachers. And, I think it sounds like a quite plain Barnett violation. But in the meantime, a student's exercise of conscience was regulated and punished, and that's not consistent with the Constitution.
Yeah, and it's amazing that after 75 years, these cases seem to arise about once every 6 months, that people are so ignorant of what the Constitution is and says.
The profession of patriotism, Jackson wrote, is, most meaningful when it's a free act. When it's compelled, it sort of is the antithesis of what it proclaims.
Absolutely. I'm impressed that you've got those quotations memorized, but I'm not surprised. John Barrett, thank you so much for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I really appreciate your insights, and I expect that this is a topic we'll be following for the next 6 months or a year or 18 months. Who knows?
I think it will be an ongoing topic, and it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Great. Thanks again.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
That's all the time we have this week for The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to join us next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. Don't forget to tell your friends where to find us, and feel free to leave comments or suggestions on our website at beringdrift.com. We'll be waiting for you here at The Score.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score?
write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.